and nothing odd about that. Now you ask if I have a magnet and I spin it about some axis of symmetry, then there is no time-varying magnetic field, there's no radiation, right? But then you can ask, is that true to all orders? Okay, so you've killed the leading order of radiation. Is that true to all orders?
You still produce the current?
No, right? I mean, if I just have a magnetic... I mean, I'm just saying that if you have total symmetry, then there's no time-varying field. So there's no radiation, okay? At that order. Now, if you ask a little bit more carefully, a little bit more slowly, why is that true, right? It's because of the fact that, you know, if you have to radiate some angular momentum, your photon must carry some angular momentum with it. Now, that photon, therefore, has to couple to some moment in the star because it's got some angular momentum, right? But if your star is completely axisymmetric, if you or your magnet or whatever is completely axisymmetric, then that coupling basically vanishes. Does that make sense? Because of symmetry, there's no angular momentum. Okay, but it's kinematically possible. Obviously, I should be able to lose some angular momentum and slow down. You know, and you've got some light degrees of freedom around that should make this possible. So the question that therefore becomes: what is the next level at which there is a coupling between a mode of angular momentum and the symmetric star, okay? And the next level at which you have a coupling is basically absorption, right? So if I take a axisymmetric object and I throw a photon at it, and the photon has got some angular momentum, right? Then that photon will get absorbed in this material. And by absorption, that basically means it'll go and stir something in it, right? It'll.
So you make a distinction between sort of continuous medium approximation of
real atoms, exactly. Yeah. So if I have a medium that cannot absorb, right, then this process won't happen.
Isn't it in quantum mechanical terms? Isn't it that you were talking about diagonal matrix elements there, and now you are talking about non-diagonal?
I'm talking about interactions. Yes.
If you have like a disk hanging on a wire or something, and you absorb a lot of photons, it will start spinning, right? And you don't really need to worry about atoms in the entire.
No, but you
need to break it in two disks and start rotating one in respect to another.
Because if you just have a disk that has no charges at all, right, or the charge is completely uniformly there, when your photon is trying to couple to it, mm-hmm. what will it couple to? It's when you do the, you know, there's some integral that you're doing, right? At the end of the day, there is some integral that you do, which is the integral over angular momentum, right, of d omega of the photon's wave function, right? I mean, it's a typical thing they're trying to do. There's some a times a mu whatever lm with some charge densities lm. And basically, there's like a transition rule, right? You have to, because of the orthogonality, if these two things are the same, then it's possible for you to couple. If not, there is no coupling. So that's really what's going on here.
So this is another condition that throw is an ideal like continuous.
Yeah, yeah, a continuous distribution, exactly, yeah.
Actually, is it possible? Can you write a macroscopic Lagrangian?
A what Lagrangian?
Write a macroscopic Lagrangian.
Macroscopic?
Microscopic.
Microscopic, okay.
Explain how you generalize it to the star as a collection of atoms.
Right. And so for a star, you know, okay, good. So let's take a very specific example, like the axion, yeah. Right? So the axion couples to electromagnetism through an operator of this form, let's say E dot B. Okay? Now, if you have a background magnetic field coming from the star, for example, like a pulsar, the axion can come in and convert to a photon. Okay, and that photon will drive currents in the star. And that's absorption. That's the basic process. In a black hole, it would just be the black, your stuff comes in, it gets absorbed into the black hole.
And then you don't need any, by the way.
You don't need anything else.
You don't need, there is just the gravitation.
It's just gravity, yes.
So this discussion about magnetic fields,
I'm just giving it as an example of what the process
the
is.
The angular momentum of the black hole, and then just gravity. So the condition, the way the black hole observes, things fall in the horizon. So this is how it absorbs.
Okay.
So I and don't understand. I'm sorry.
I'm not sure.
I'm happy to drop it if everybody else is happy. But I don't understand. So I have this coupling in the Lagrangian.
Correct.
I have a background dipole magnetic field.
Say for a pulsar, there's a background magnetic field. Let's say I'm shooting an axion at it.
And I produce an actual photon.
Right. Right.
But in this logic, taking noble gas, you wouldn't have any interaction of the photon with the noble gas because it's absolutely spherically symmetric. You need to excite it.
Right, that's right.
Then you can absorb.
That's exactly the point. Right. Yeah. Okay, and that's the absorption. That's a straightforward process that everybody understands. You know, I'm throwing something at it, it sticks. That's basically what it is. So that means now I've got a matrix element, right? I've got a coupling between a star with some angular momentum, star going out with some other angular momentum, and there's some stellar excitation, and this thing coming in. So that coupling now exists. Previously, that coupling was zero when you're trying to do your dipole radiation, right? That was zero because of symmetry. But now that's the next level at which it exists. And once it exists, there's a kinematic condition, which basically says, when do I radiate? Okay, that's the kinematics basically saying that I need to lose enough energy and angular momentum to produce both an outgoing photon as well as some stellar excitation. Okay, and that will be satisfied for a mode of sufficiently high angular momentum. It'll turn out that's true. And all of those modes are super radiant. They'll all be emitted. Okay.
Why can't you also emit two photons?
You can what?
Why can't you also emit two photons?
You can.
And also, just to make clear, you're competing against ordinary electromagnetism, which has this.
Yeah. So exactly. So in fact, ordinary electromagnetism is super radiant, right? Now you can ask, when is it ever efficient? So most of the time, this is a very, very weak process. Like you know, this is subdominant to your actual dipole radiation.
Sorry, but your bound orbits are restricted inside the Schwarzschild radius by definition somehow.
Your what?
No, they're
not. No, please, can I finish this?
Okay.
So the important point is this, right? Is that if your particle actually has a mass, the particle that you're emitting has a mass, then you can do more things than just sort of super radiant. Because normally your super radiance, all it'll ever do is just sort of produce some particle once in a while. It's a very slow emission, doesn't do anything for photons, things like that, right? But in the very limited case when the particle actually happens to have a mass, then you automatically, quantum mechanics gives you these bound states. Those exist, and you can emit into those. Okay? And that gives you essentially an exponential amplification.
Yeah. These states just have much bigger dipole moment than the star. Right? So that basically gives you a constant.
Well, it's more like once you radiate into them, the fact that you're starting to populate that level means that you will, you know, there's like a Bose enhancement into that rate. That's basically the point.
So they kind of like give you a cavity around the star. And
that's right.
These are basically a way to.
Exactly. Yes?
Why guarantee bound states?
Why you're. But this is just gravity, right? So I've got this is some scalar field, for example, that's in the. It's interacting with us through gravity. So you write down its Klein-Gordon equation. There will be a.
In quantum mechanics, and then
you can have a satellite around this star. You can have a particle around this star.
It's the hydrogen atom, exactly. Yeah.
In quantum mechanics, in a three-dimensional potential, doesn't guarantee bound states.
No, but it's a 1/r² potential. There's a potential due to gravity.
Yeah, it's hydrogenic spectrum.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that's right. It's just the fact that gravity gives a 1/r potential, and there's a. There are bound states of that potential, right? And whether or not there's a bound state or not depends upon the mass. If the mass went to zero, then it's a relativistic particle. It won't be bound. It'll be far away. But for a particle of some finite mass, there will be some bound state at some distance.
Okay.
Let's
face the question. Why is this energetically favorable?
Why is this? Well, because of the fact that you're actually, your star spins down. It's like friction, if you will, right? You'd much rather prefer to emit this guy and slow down. That's all. It's like any decay process. I've got a state of high speed, high angular momentum. I can go down to low angular momentum by creating this, and that you can show occurs. Like there's now a matrix element. Then there comes a sort of a thermodynamic argument where you can actually go around and say that actually the entropy is in fact lowered by doing this. There's a great paper by Jacob Bekenstein on this particular topic. And I can send it to you or whatever, and it conserves that particular quantity. Okay. Yes?
Okay, this is maybe a naive question. Which direction is the super radiance coming out of in this case then? Is it coming out into the clouds?
It's sort of populating the clouds. It's basically populating the cloud.
Oh.
Yeah. Yes.
Later on, do you show that the efficiency of this process goes up with increasing L at
Ah, I will tell you, yes, so I'll show
so,
you.
So why would you expect that? That seems counterintuitive.
No, I don't think it goes increasingly with L. It's more like, I mean, that may look like it. But, so usually what's happening is the following, right, is that the size of the star is small compared to the Bohr radius. So at large L, this is a suppression.
Yeah.
Because it goes far away.
Okay, yeah.
That makes physical sense.
I thought that gamma was the efficiency or the rate or something.
Yeah, and you see that basically the R over R radius,
okay.
Bohr radius is a small number.
Okay.
Yeah, I think maybe that's what you didn't. Yeah. Okay. All right. If not, I'm happy to go and have dinner or something.
yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Here's the question.
Yes.
So sometimes I hear. Like if there is a space profile or the time profile to the accident field, there are certain modes of photons, not in the black hole diagram, but in the flat diagram, the certain modes of photons that become unstable, that there is like, you can see the statements I can point in the literature, that the evolving axion in unidirectional change actually generates magnetic field, that there is like a mode in the photon that is exponential growth. So I was wondering if anyone has looked at Maxwell's equations in the presence of this axion cloud, if there is any additional instability for photons.
Not that I know of, yeah.
What are you talking about, Maxine? I didn't hear.
I'm saying that if I can dig out the literature, that if there is like AFF dual coupling, right, and A evolves in the flat space,
yes.
Like, in unidirectional,
yeah.
In time, there will be, if you decompose photons into individual modes, you will find out that the certain k's are unstable, actually, that there is a preference for generating magnetic field,
I see, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
So there's a question now, you have a very interesting shape of this A, and whether you have to also, worry, I would say, right, solve Maxwell's equations for photons and on that diagram and see if there is...
Massless
photon, right?
R photon. Oh, yeah, there is superadding stability for photons.
No, but they can be additionally generated by...
It's talking about the fact that the axion field gets pumped up.
You store a huge energy in a non-trivial configuration of A. Now,
We estimated the rate for action.
Well, there is nothing to estimate. There is a Maxwell's equation where it enters on the right hand side, right? So now, it's whatever happens, right? I mean, one has to go through that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Big R there, what is it?
That's the size of the star, roughly. It's the size where you have, for the black hole, it would be like roughly the Schwarzschild radius.
Right.
For neutron star, it would actually be the surface. Yeah.
Yeah. What is the size of this radius in numbers for a given m, for a given mu? So I didn't put in the numbers, but compared to the Schwarzschild radius, what is the size of your R?
Well, so that depends upon, on the mass, right? What you take it to be. So typically, it's now all a question about like how extremal your object actually is. Okay, so if you get a really extremal object where omega r is order 1, right, then you can go very, very to sort of pretty high masses, mu exactly equal to m, right? And then you could, your Bohr radii are very close. It's roughly an order 1 number. But if you're not that extremal, then that sort of rapidly drops. And as you see, this is a very, very rapid function of that parameter, right? If you're off in your measurement of your rotation by, say, factors of something, that very rapidly kills your rate.
And for ordinary star, this is small.
This is small, yes. Yeah, because essentially ordinary stars are not extremal. You can kind of see that. I'm going the wrong way, sorry. You essentially want to be, like, it's this condition, okay? Which is the fact that you want to maximize this, and that basically means that if you are either too light or too heavy, it's not good. So you want to be roughly around sort of rotation rates that are comparable to the mass of the object. And then you want to increase it even more which basically means you want to pump these numbers as high as possible, right? Now, mu is order omega, but you want omega r, but by relativity, omega r needs to be order 1. It can't be bigger than that. And that's what makes you extremal. So if you move away from that level, that limit of being extremal, your rate gets very, very suppressed. That's the bottom line.
And where do the axions come from?
Where do the axions come from?
Yes.
Well, you know, there's some coupling in the Lagrangian that just produces it. So in the case of the
your star is populating this.
The star is populating it. Yes.
Does the amplitude of the axion
field
in this
cloud
as a vector approach at
play? It can, indeed. And there are these constraints by a couple of Japanese authors on what happens when, you know, it sort of really gets that large.
This is the Bozanov effect.
Yeah.
I mean, we wrote it with Sergei back in the day, and the Japanese actually did numerical simulations and confirmed.
Right. So when you populate these states by axions, do they live there forever?
Well, they can, not forever, because indeed they can decay through gravity wave emission, as Mina and Sergei pointed out in one of their papers. This is like pretty much any other excited state in the world, right? There are ways in which you can depopulate it afterwards. So the question is, and for a sort of a reasonable range of parameters, you will populate and it will stay for quite some time before your very slow decay actually happens. Yes?
Is there a region where the decay rate into diphotons is sufficiently large?
Because, like, you know, the decay rate into diphotons is always just given by the axion mass, right? It's not enhanced by your coherence.
And I know, but
yeah.
Is there a region where that effect is large enough so that you accumulate it around the star and you start seeing the star shining in...
Not really, right? Because if you look at it, these masses are like kilohertz, roughly,
mm-hmm.
and F is some very large number. So the decay rate is always very, very small.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, the brightness, so it's very hard to... The other thing is that at those very small masses, there is the region around the black hole or the star, whatever, it's ionized. So this, the plasma mass is so it is not obvious these things even escape the vicinity. So brightness.
Mm-hmm.
So in principle, if you were to calculate some numbers, you will find some rate. It won't kill the effect. You may imagine some rate that you imagine observing, but it's not obvious they even escape the vicinity
mm-hmm.
of the object that produces it.
So, Bakhtir, you have that, well, it's not about the issue, but this question was isotope condensation of axions that you were to discuss.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that I don't want to discuss that. So
no, you have.
Okay.
I have the hockey stick in my hand.
Can you explain why you don't want to discuss this? You don't need to discuss it. Just explain why you don't want.
Oh, I just don't understand it well enough to. That's the polite answer.
I have some questions about Evgeny's talk.
You had a question.
Well, yes. Don't you have a macroscopic occupancy in one of the modes?
You do. Yeah.
Isn't that? What did you call that?
No. I think this is talking about the claimed BC of the axion in the galaxy today.
Oh, not
what,
around your star.
Not around my star.
But around your star, would you call
around my star, I'm happy to say that it is indeed a BC.
Well, in the galaxy.
Is anybody not afraid to discuss this topic? What about, like, people?
Well,
I think Maxim said that he's happy to discuss it.
Well,
so, Maxim,
go ahead.
Yeah, I think there is a number of controversies and confusion going, right? So there is a statement that in certain backgrounds of gravitational fields, the axions due to their self-gravitating interaction somehow go to the Bose-Einstein condensate, right? And there are some other people saying, oh, the Bose-Einstein condensate and classical field configurations are the same. This, I don't think, is right, although. So there is like a number of confused discussions in the relationship, but I think, like, yeah, the potential and particles go to the, you know, like Bose-Einstein condensate, they form like one gigantic wave function, right? And this is separate from what I understand the classical field. The classical field usually means large occupation number, but also large in uncertainty in the number of quanta. That's the transition to classical regime. So I think.
Right, I mean,
Bose-Einstein condensate and classical field is not the same.
That's true.
And then also, what I think for these experiments, if, let's say, Bose-Einstein condensation for curve, right? Then there would be probably a mode that has almost infinite coherence,
correct,
right?
Yes, yes.
I mean that,
yes.
That instead of this,
the Q can be very large.
Squared kind of factor-controlled coherence, right? That sort of six orders of magnitude.
Exactly. It can be very, a field will be common forever, for a very long time.
That will be like, not all of them, but some fraction of them will be, if some light field, interacting with whatever spin or mass, goes into Bose-Einstein condensate, there will be, a mode with, right. Bose-Einstein condensate of some astrophysical scales, right?
Yes.
Right.
It will
yes.
be mode with a like infinite
variance. So is there some argument that this is not that this is not in fact the dominant?
It is well.
So there's the simplest thing you have to have is just you have a classical field that has a coherence time which is a million times the period.
Yeah.
Right. That you have to have. That's the minimal coherence. But if it has, in order to form a real BEC, meaning, so even in that case, there will be macroscopic occupation numbers of many, 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 many quantum states in the galaxy. Gigantic occupation numbers, but of many, many states. So I don't care, whether or not you call that a BEC, whatever. However, if you want them to all go to one state, which is what we normally think of as a BEC in the lab or whatever, right? That would be one state or a lot of, some significant fraction to go to one state. That would be when they have, that mode has gigantic coherence length. Then you need some interaction. I mean, anyone who makes a BEC in the lab knows this, right? in fact, the only claims I'm aware of are Pierre Sahivi's claims, and I don't think he even claims in the galaxy. I don't think he would say in the galaxy it's actually forming this very high coherent state. I think he would just say actually in the early universe before nonlinear structure formation forms that.
One of the controversies is whether or not what you can count as an interaction to bring things into the BEC. So I think one of Sahivi's argument is that you can count the gravitational attraction as an attraction that can pull you into a BEC. But an argument against this is that you've kind of counted that already in computing the linear growth and getting things into potentials anyway, so you can't count it again as something that goes towards the BEC. And I think that would kind of be related to what you're saying about structure formation. So you shouldn't expect things to carry on once structure formation is happening.
Yeah, I don't know what happens when structure formation happens. I think even without the density and homogeneities, gravity could be strong enough to make it a BEC, or it could be too weak to make it a BEC. And I don't think it's, in that early universe, I don't think it's already counted. Whether or not it is strong enough is a difficult question that I don't know, but I can't say for certain it's not.
Maxim, so do you mean that in the early universe, when the axial field first came out, started to oscillate, it could not have been a Bose-Einstein condensate at that time?
I would rather describe it as a classical field.
Yeah, I think that's a better way to say it.
At that point, there is a distinction, right? I mean, like, Bose-Einstein condensate could be, like, n identical quanta, right? Classical field is large occupation number and large uncertainty in the occupation number.
It's more like a coherent state, not a
coherent
state.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, in practical sense, maybe there isn't much of a difference.
As you said,
the early cosmology. Right?
No, in the early cosmology, I don't think it would make a difference.
But although
Pierre Sahivi claims by changing the initial conditions, if you go to full true BEC. That actually makes caustics and things like that after nonlinear structure formation. I think that's rather difficult to prove.
The other thing is that if you put the Bose-Einstein condensate in a very fast requiring time dependent field, the Bose-Einstein condensate starts losing coherence. So it's not obvious that even if you form that BEC, if you form, that's a big if, if it will survive galactic evolution, because the galaxy mixes a lot and baryons dominate the gravitational field close to the disk. So it's a million years, so it's very fast in cosmological scale. So. It's not so all the statements about caustics, which is also true for dark matter, by the way. Ordinary, there's a, Sagiba makes several claims, which is not obvious, which are not necessarily followed by equations.
Well, or more specifically, one can ask, is there really an observable difference between axion dark matter and WIMP dark matter, right? And for that, you know, WIMPs at long distances look like classical fields. I mean, you can add them, there's a fluid equation.
Let me ask you
back.
So suppose you have a component that has an infinite, you know, coherence length, but you still don't know its frequency, right? I mean, so... Is there
no,
like
but it helps.
It helps.
You can use a bigger cube. By the way, this is let's take a more practical question. Even forget forming a BC in the galaxy. Pierre Sagiba and the ADMX people pointed the following point out, which is very beautiful for axions or any light field, dark photons. If you have an object, a stream, you know, the Milky Way is eating a local object which had a small velocity dispersion. So this is what the Sagittarius stream is supposed to be, probably this. Then, you know, if we're in the presence of such a stream that was coming from a small velocity dispersion, it could, that has a velocity dispersion of, I believe, v10⁻⁴, so it would have q of 10 to the 8. That component of the dark matter, actually, you could have a q of 10 to the 8, and your thing would, your detector, ADMX or Casper or whatever, would respond much more strongly. So that would actually really help with, if you would, by the way, set the detector to have such a high q. So ADMX only has a q of 10 to the 6, but if you have a higher q, you can really make take advantage of that. And in fact, actually, a neat thing
and
to
it's
point
actually
out,
much more useful at higher frequency, because then we can actually scan for...
And a neat thing they point out is actually, you know, let's say you do have these streams. It's actually probably the best assumption that you do have different streams going through. Something like, or a general axiom experiment would actually pick out the velocity structure, right? You would scan and actually see multiple peaks. One for the Sagittarius stream, you know, if you had really fine resolution. One for the Sagittarius stream, a broader one for the background axion dark matter.
What happens with the axion clumping? Like, people discuss WIMPs because it's so easy, right? And I heard statements made that the axions may clump even stronger, right? Is that right?
Well, if you can set up an initial amplitude that is large enough somewhere, then you can have sub-interactions that are important that can do that. But
not through self-interaction, just from the gravitational.
It's the same.
So
long as you're talking about structures noticeably longer than the wavelength of the particle, then the quantum effects don't matter. Then the formula, the equations really are the same.
Oh, the same.
Once you talk about things around the wavelength of the particle, of course.
No, the equations are slightly different because it matters when WIMP decouples from the normal matter, right? So here the axion are never coupled, right? So
you mean they start colder? There's a different initial condition.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, but that scale might be very microscopic. So
it
depends on what is the size of the scale, right? When
That's right. So
the
WIMPs may decouple at you know, around the mean heat temperature, maybe slightly earlier, and that's where the first clump stuck, you know, collapsing, right?
No,
the really small scale, there's
radiation.
I mean, what do you mean?
I don't understand.
It's low.
What is the first fraction that is allowed to grow for WIMPs?
Right.
So there is
and
the G scale for WIMPs.
The first
no, it's true. That depends on the mass. There was a paper recently by, who actually looked at the scale of...
Not this really big...
But the very
small.
You're talking about...
Small
so you have a WIMP that becomes dominant matter radiation equality as usual. But because it has decoupled at some time, there's some pre-streaming of the WIMP. This is what you're talking about?
Well, this is numerical simulation people, right? Have predictions for various forms of dark matter, right? And for them, it matters whether this is WIMPs or axions. And I only ask whether there is, you know, a significant difference between clumps of WIMPs and clumps of axions.
In principle, no, unless you have self-interactions.
I think the statements were, I remember from...
I think it's a question of what the mass is, right?
It's the G scale, right?
No, but it also depends on the sort of velocity dispersion in the region, right? On the time of the decoupling.
I would think that you could work out to make dark matter as hot as allowed by current observations, so stellar neutrinos or something. You could, right? And for axions, saying they're born cold.
Yes.
Ordinary dark matter.
No, but they're even
hot,
colder than
WIMPs.
They're even colder than WIMPs. That's what I'm trying to say.
Right, but for, I mean, it's possible to model build a WIMP scenario that is hot enough to make a distinction. It would give you a cutoff.
I don't go to hot direction. cold, right? I mean, this
the is usual situation, a GV stuff, I mean, something that decoupled at MEV will be, to all purposes, infinitely cold. I mean, for, I mean, as far as I know, for, unless you find a way to probe the structure, you know, structure formation on very, very small
scale.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, because I'm not talking about structure formation at a kiloparsec scales or anything. I'm talking about, what about the, you know, really super small clumps of, because they were, you know, they were following these distributions, right, of dark matter clumps, and some people were saying that, you know, there are even over-dense smaller regions, right? But for the experiments on Earth, that can be, that's all. So there was one question about this constraints on this beam field, right?
That is not me, so I'm going to go back.
That there is the constraint on B0, right?
It should be logically 10 to negative 3 if you look at typical galactic.
Right, so velocity is. So if what I say is that if there is a constant vector everywhere in space, right? One will be liable to constraints that Mike's group puts together, and then very strong. Then, if one way out is like postulate that there are some smaller domains of this where the vector averages out, but then it will lead to some noise, right? Because you will pass through, you know, magnetometers will pass through.
Well, there's a minus 15, subset huge by 10 to the fourth, yeah.
10 to minus 15 GeV, right? So it's 10 to minus 5 EV, so it's 10 to the 10 hertz, right?
Right.
So it's not, I mean, so what I'm trying to say is even if one organizes this into the domains, one would be probably limited at some point. By the noise that this will create, right?
So you're saying it's excluded already?
I would naively guess, yes. I mean, the constant vector, there's no question about it, right? It's limited at 10 to minus 32 GeV. One can take a penalty of 4 orders of magnitude on velocity or something like that.
So I'm sitting next to a geoscientist, yeah, and we were wondering, you know, for example, if the mass of the neutron relatively changes by 10 to the minus 5, right? And then this thing flies through the Earth, G is going to change by, in the fifth significant figure two.
Yeah.
So it's going to, right? Yeah, so. I mean, the little g is going to, and it's going to change by that much for about 100 seconds, right? So, that probably would have been noticed already, right? No? Maybe there is a connection to Earth.
As recently as yesterday, we like discussed this issue with the LIGO people, and this is like a very natural instrument to look for any of that, right? Because they are very sensitive to even small displacements.
If G changes,
if it's a big thing, right, then not
bigger,
really
right?
it's
enormous, right?
But little g does wiggle, though, in time.
Yeah, right?
Jason, what's the number?
We have beta.
Yeah, there he's looking at beta on this.
So
3,000 microns.
So
the 10 to the minus, like, 6.
But you can make a spatially correlated.
There's all these kind of bubbles
explain
a bit of lot of it.
Sure, yeah, it's all of them. That's what I missed.
So, the question is what's
the point? I don't know.
How much G changes over day, for example?
So it's like 10 to the minus 6 little g. Yeah, 10 to the minus 5. 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6. But then, as Mike was saying, then you can explain a lot of that knowing the tides and stuff, right? I mean, probably. You guys know this.
But you can also make it, you can make a spatially correlated measurement, right? Because you'll see the entire waveform moving towards you.
through
right.
you.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see a correlated change in G.
Okay, okay.
This is an easy, naive question. Is there a reason there's no optical ADMX because nobody wants an EV energy scale, or because you lose by that omega squared factor in the coupling, or is there no?
It's easy to explain for the QCD axions, right? The electron wall scale would correspond to much smaller FA, which will be viable to all the stellar constraints that Joseph was talking about. So it will be deeply inside the excluded region, because it will predict, you know, enormously fast burning of the sun of other stars. So.
But then for axion-like particles, that's no longer true,
but,
right?
But then you can play the games of releasing the tight connection between coupling and the mass, right? And start looking for in EV range, but with a smaller coupling, so that you know, not enough. And then, I mean, the stars don't put constraints, right?
And
I would say if you can beat the stellar constraint it by itself, it's, you know, it's already going to be quite something. So there is only like a very limited number of examples where people can actually do better in the lab compared to the on-light particles, compared to stellar constraints.
I mean, basically, when you're looking at sort of this high frequency, there are a couple of problems that hit you. One of which is that the field is not covalent for as long, because the covalence time depends upon the mass. And that tends to affect you in terms of your sensitivity of how you're trying to get it. And secondly, at high frequencies, people have issues building like resonators, things like that, matched to that well.
Well,
so at ADMX,
optical cavity.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
I mean, but optical cavities are directional. You can
generate
and come out.
Yeah, you can do
it.
Yeah,
but a second. So you lose some coherence time, which never helps. And then a second issue is you lose volume. Because it can be long, but the transverse size probably isn't as big. But, you know, that's an experimental.
In fact, but that's an experiment. You know, suddenly, at ADMX right now, there's a pretty active effort to go to high frequency.
Like a light
So they're talking about optical.
Very serious.
Yeah,
that's true.
Just take the magnets from the LHC.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Decommissioned Fermilab magnets. So we've got those ones flying around, you know.
Do vector particles form these same kind of topological defects, like pseudoscalar particles or scalar particles?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you take this dark photon model of Jeremy, there will be a topological defect built in there called Abrikosov-Nielsen-Olesen string, right? So there will be one-dimensional defect, right, where the symmetry will be restored on the inside, so this dark photon on the inside of the string will become massless, and the effective electromagnetic coupling will become larger there because of the more efficient mixing of the normal photon and the dark photon. So it's really cool stuff. Yeah, so in these models, expecting defects is the most natural thing.
Unless it's a Stoppelberg.
Unless it's a Stoppelberg.
Which is more natural.
I don't know why.
Can you sort of explain the very hard-weighted way? Is it kind of axial business? How do these defects come about? Is it just the gluon field by itself? Or?
How the defects arise in the...
Yeah, just for kind of QCD axial.
Oh, for the QCD axial? Well, it a little bit depends on the model of the QCD axions, but usually it's an existence of several degenerate but non-equivalent minima that give rise to domain walls, right? And
Well, first there are strings when PQ breaks, because PQ is a U1. So first you make the strings.
Right.
And then exactly, then when the thing, so then that's a very many, you know, for a lot of range of energy, then it's just the strings. And then you get the, you know, it says, think of the Mexican hat, I'd show the hands. And then you get the little tilt, and you have exactly these different vacua. So then the places, the strings were where you sat on the top of that potential. Then the places in the middle will all fall down to the bottom, leaving you with kind of funny, like, domain walls between each of the networks of strings. So it looks like a, you know, soap bubbles or something. So anyway, that's, and then, yeah, those, but then those, the network then undergoes some complex, you know, what actually happens as it goes through the universe and evolves and stuff is more complicated. But,
for actions?
Yeah.
No, there is, for actions, it depends on the structure of the action potential. If there is cases, it depends on how many the action is periodic. The action potential is cosine potential, it's periodic from 0 to 5. So the question is, do you have two degenerate vacua at 0 to 5, when you plot it like this, or is there an additional vacua? So if there's one more additional vacua, one or more, the domain wall network is actually stable and does not care. So in that case, you have to add it, and that's actually cosmologically deadly. If the P2 phase transition happens after the end of the inflation. So you have to be careful. The cosmology can get very complicated once the P2 phase transition happens after the end of inflation. And also, the other important thing is that the production of axions now is not dominated by the usual misalignment mechanism, but is dominated by the decay of strings and domain walls. And this is where the if you look at what happens with bicycles, let's say bicycles, correct? Look at now what the range would be. Actually, now the range is compressed to be roughly a factor of 30 between the astrophysical bands from stars and the overabundance of axions produced by strings in domain walls. And there is lots of discussion in the literature to go back and talk about the ancillaries, but it's roughly. It gets pretty complicated pretty fast.
All right. So on that note, I suggest we maybe